Species.
Unite.
Species.
Unite.
I think to some extent it shows that we don't want to have knowledge that will make us uncomfortable or make us feel that we're doing something wrong. And I get that from people quite often, you know. So they don't really know me very well, but they ask me what I'm doing, and I mention something about that I've written about animals and the way animals raised for food treated. And then they say, oh, don't tell me, you'll spoil my dinner.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. In 1975, Peter Singer changed the way we talk about how we treat animals in our food system, in research, and everywhere else we use, exploit, and torture them. He gave the world Animal Liberation, the book that gave birth to generations of animal activists, advocates, vegans, and the animal rights movement. And last week, a new version of Animal Liberation entered the world. This one is a whole new book because a lot has happened in 50 years. And sadly, a lot hasn't happened. Peter and I met a few days before the book came out to talk about what has changed, and more importantly, what needs to change.
I'm really happy to be speaking to you out in this beautiful spot in Central Park. And speaking of other species, there's a couple of birds just around.
So good to have you. I'm so honored. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth. It's great to be with you.
Animal Liberation Now comes out tomorrow. I read it this weekend thinking that I was going to be reading a revised edition of Animal Liberation. I didn't have any idea that it was basically a completely new book.
Yes, there are a lot of things that have happened over the last 50 years, not surprisingly, and I hadn't updated it since 1990, so even that's 33 years. So I did want to put in a lot of new material, change some things, talk about the progress that has been made since those early editions, and also I wanted to bring in climate change, which was not really on the horizon when I first wrote the book. And is an important factor when we're considering what we eat.
Yeah, no one was talking about climate change in the 70s, were they?
No, I first became aware of it in 1984. I was visiting the University of Colorado at Boulder, and NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, was just a little bit down the road. So they all knew about it, and it was starting to spread to the philosophy department and people interested in ethical issues about the future of our planet.
The first version of this book, Animal Liberation, came out in 1975, and it changed so many lives of humans and of animals, clearly. It's still very, very powerful. I talk to people all the time who that is what changed them. In fact, there's probably been, I don't know, 175 to 200 people who've come on this podcast. And the ones that I ask, why did you go vegan? At least two-thirds say Animal Liberation, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, that's really nice. That's great. Yeah.
No, we don't have a lot of 20-somethings and 30-somethings on.
Right.
But everybody else. Oh, yeah, Animal Liberation. Oh, I read Animal Liberation right in college. And at the time when it came out, not only was it like it changed so much, it started the animal rights movement, but when people were, like groups were doing things like breaking into labs or, you know, doing these kind of acts of revolution in terms of helping animals, they would leave a copy.
I heard about that at the time, and yeah. I was pretty impressed, I have to say. Yeah. Yeah. But as for what you said about the 20 and 30-year-olds, that's really why I did this new book, because I do want them to get engaged. Some of them are, of course, but I want more of them to get engaged. And I want to give them the ethical framework that I had there combined with relevant and up-to-date material to situate the whole problem within the context of 2023 and decade or two to come.
So much has changed since in the 50 years since you wrote this. There's vegan restaurants everywhere. I know a lot of vegans. We all know a lot of vegans now. It's not this weird thing anymore. So you feel like it's really changed for animals, but that's not truly the case.
Yes, things have changed in terms of the awareness of being vegan and being plant-based, and really very few people would have even understood what that word meant when the book first came out. But for animals, no. I mean, certainly in terms of numbers, and again, particularly if you look at it globally, there are more animals in factory farms today than there were in 1975. Part of that is the fact that there are also more people, and more people mean more animals being consumed. But even on a per capita basis, probably worldwide, when you include the big growth in eating meat in China, just because it's become a bit more prosperous or a bit less poor, yeah, it's got worse.
What are some of the real positives that have happened since you wrote this? Areas where you're like, wow, we did that, or we've succeeded here?
The movement has succeeded in a number of ways. So in the original edition of Animal Liberation, and still in the 1990 version, I was particularly concerned about three forms of very close confinement of animals. Both veal calves and breeding sows were standardly kept in individual crates that really would just widen the animal, and the animal could not turn around. And that was deliberate because they wanted the feces to all be in one spot where they could hose it away more easily. And they didn't want the animal to be able to turn around. And the other end was, you know, where the food went in. So that was a really totally miserable life for the veal calves and the sows. And that's prohibited now across the entire European Union, all 27 countries, across the United Kingdom, in California and a handful of other states of the US. And that's progress. And the same is roughly true for laying hens, the egg-laying hens, kept in cages too small for them to be able to stretch their wings. In fact, too small for them to be able to stretch their wings, even if there's just one bird per cage, but there's likely to be four or five birds in each of those cages. So extremely crowded. You have to give laying hens significantly more space in the European Union, the UK, and those other countries, and some of those states in the United States. So yeah, those are big wins. They were strongly opposed by the animal movement, but we managed to win them. We managed to win them in the US largely by bringing referenda initiatives, or threatening to bring them in some states where then the legislature would act rather than realize it was going to lose a referendum. Whereas in the parliamentary democracies of the UK and the European Union, they did go through the more standard political channels, which I think shows that those political systems reflect the views of electors better than the United States does.
When you first wrote this 50 years ago, did you expect or think, like, when people actually find out what's happening to animals, they're going to do something?
Yeah, I did think that, really, because it just seemed shocking to me when I first learned about it. You know, you have to realize I was 24 years old and I did not know that animals were inside. The animals I was eating, the chickens and pigs, would have all been reared inside, or almost all reared inside. And I was, you know, an educated person. I was a graduate student at the University of Oxford. And I did not know that I was eating animals kept in conditions that were really horrible for them and were basically just geared to producing them as cheaply as possible, irrespective of what it meant for their lives. So that was shocking to me, and I did think that when other people learned about that, they would say, at least I'm not going to buy factory farming. You know, maybe they weren't going to go vegan or even vegetarian, but at least they would say, I'll make sure that what I eat doesn't come from factory farmed animals.
And I mean, a lot did, obviously. So many people went vegan because of your book. But in the bigger picture, the needle hasn't moved that much mainstream.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you add a few percentage to the number of people who are not eating meat, but it still remains clearly less than 10% in most countries. And that means that 90% of people are eating meat and really haven't changed very much what they're eating.
And factory farming, there's horrible examples in this version, horrible examples in that version, because it hasn't changed that much, especially in the US.
It's a little bit better in the EU, and it has changed in a few states. California is an example, and just last month, the pork producers actually lost their attempt to try to overturn the Californian law as far as it applied to pig products imported from other states, and they failed, so that's a good thing. But in terms of the states where the majority of farmed animals are produced in the United States, no, there's no change in the law and very small changes in the conditions. I think the campaigns of some animal organizations for cage-free eggs have got, I think it's now about a third of US hens are no longer in cages. That's progress, but firstly, there's still two-thirds who are. Secondly, the majority of those who are not in cages are not truly free range. They're still very crowded. They're still indoors all their lives. It's certainly better than being in cages, but it's nowhere near good enough.
There's a lot of people in this country that say, you know, I don't eat factory farmed animals. I only eat animals that were grown on a farm, or, you know, that lived outside and had a really happy life. But the numbers tell us that that can't possibly be true. Right.
Yeah, like absolutely
if
right.
If you're eating meat, you're eating factory farm meat pretty much.
You would have to be extremely conscientious in searching out alternatives to not be eating factory farm meat. For some of those animals, particularly chicken, say, it's extremely tiny percentage that are really not factory farmed.
The same goes for animals that are experimented on. The examples in your book, in this version of your book, are all updated since the last version, or mostly. And they're equally as atrocious and devastating.
Yes, I think that's true. Maybe there are some of the experiments that would not be done now. The so-called learned helplessness experiments in which dogs were given inescapable electric shock until they just passively accepted it because they couldn't get out of it. And this was supposed to have some relevance to depression in humans. You know, there's nothing that's come from that that's helped humans in depression, really. But I don't think that would be done today. It certainly wouldn't be done on dogs. And even people who did that, people like Martin Seligman, seemed to think that it would have been okay to do it on rats, although, you know, now they regret that they did it on dogs. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if it's an animal capable of feeling pain from electric shock, it's wrong to do it. And obviously, if the animals weren't feeling pain from the electric shock, the experiment wouldn't work anyway.
Yes, of course. In those situations, though, there's like kind of been a fake news about how there's more welfare, there's more concern for animals in labs than there was when you started out.
Yeah. So again, you know, it's not 100% fake news. There are these institutional animal care and use committees, which did not exist when I put out the first edition. I think they have some effect in universities and academic institutions, because the fact that people who are wanting to do experiments know that they're going to be looked at by these committees, and at least one person on the committee is not going to be a researcher. I think it does mean that they think a little bit more about what they're doing for some of these things, like the tests. You know, in the 1990s, 80s and 90s, my friend Henry Spira, who actually used to live just across Central Park from where we are now, had these campaigns against the Dreyer's eye test, in which cosmetics companies were putting substances directly into the eyes of unanesthetized rabbits who were also immobilized in little boxes with just their heads sticking out so that they couldn't dislodge the substance from their eye. And there was also the LD50 test, in which you tested substances until you'd poisoned to death 50% of your sample. The number of those tests being done has been reduced. And in fact, you know, in Europe, where there are good statistics, you can see that they have dropped quite a lot. So there might still be some thousands of those experiments done, but not hundreds of thousands anymore. In the United States, the crazy thing is that there are no official statistics on the numbers of rats, mice, or birds used in experiments. And that's, according to one estimate by a scientist, that's 99% of the experiments. And even according to the lobbyists for animal research, they acknowledge it's 95% of experiments. So, you know, that's just crazy. And it's completely, you know, different from all of the other developed countries, like all the European Union countries, the United Kingdom, Australia, Canada. They don't exempt the majority of animals used in experiments from their regulations or their statistical coverage.
The U.S. is pretty shameful across the board, like with factory farmed animals and animals in testing in comparison.
I think that's true. The other countries I've just named, the U.S. is more backward, harsher on animals, and the exceptions are largely those states where you can have a citizen-initiated referendum, and that's what's made a difference in California and the great majority of the states that have passed some laws for farmed animals, say regulating that they need to be able to turn around. You can't keep them in a stall or crate so narrow that they can't even turn around or walk. So I think Americans as citizens, as individuals, given a chance to vote on these things, would vote for better conditions than America has. But the political system is so corrupt and so influenced by money and lobbyists that you can't get these changes at the federal level. And of course you can't get them in states that are dominated by raising animals for food, because, you know, Nebraska, Iowa, North Carolina, those interests just dominate the legislatures.
People don't want to knowingly cause harm to animals, even though they're eating them. That disconnect hasn't really changed since in the 50 years.
Not in general. I mean, again, it's changed for some individuals, but it's a small percentage of the population. It's interesting, isn't it, that people are prepared to vote for a policy which prohibits practices that they are supporting, you know, right up to the time when they vote. And of course, the law isn't instantly effective. So as they vote, they're clearly still eating products of these animals, and yet they're voting against it. Well, okay, it's better that they're voting against it than they're not voting against it, but it would be good if they would stop eating them even beforehand.
Watching this whole thing for 50 years, now we have social media, now we have the internet, we see all this stuff with the world kind of growing up with this knowledge, and we're still not like massively shifting. What does that say about the human condition?
I think to some extent it shows that we don't want to have knowledge that will make us uncomfortable or make us feel that we're doing something wrong. And I get that from people quite often, you know, say they don't really know me very well, but they ask me what I'm doing and I mention something about that I've written about animals and the way animals raised for food are treated. And then they say, oh, don't tell me, you'll spoil my dinner. And really, when you think of it, that's a pretty horrible moral attitude. It's a moral attitude that we've seen before and in other occasions, of course, of people looking away from atrocities that were being done to humans. And sometimes, for example, in Nazi Germany, if they had not looked away, they might have themselves suffered. You know, they might have been rounded up and sent to the concentration camps as well if they'd protested. But here, you know, nobody's going to come after you if you say, I don't want to eat meat because I've found out about how they're treated. So it's in a sense, it's even worse because there's less at stake for people and they still won't find out about things that might more or less compel them to change what they're eating or else to feel horribly guilty about the fact that they are eating it.
But on this like greater population where we really need people to shift, maybe not change completely, but shift, what is the solution?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. I would certainly be doing it. I think, though, it's going to be, you know, many different solutions, and I think we have to try them all. So there's kind of reason and argument. As a philosopher, that's what I've been doing. That's what I do in the book. And I talk to students about it when I teach. And I do now have some good, hard evidence that philosophy classes lead to a shift. Because I did a study with Eric Schwitzgebel, a professor at University of California, Riverside. The interesting thing about Riverside is, firstly, they have very large introductory philosophy classes. And secondly, students buy their meals at the student at the university cafeteria using their ID cards. So that made it possible, Eric realized, to firstly divide the students randomly. So you got one group talking, just doing one class, not a whole course, about the ethics of eating animals, and another group doing a different ethics topic altogether as a control group. And secondly, you could find out what the students in each group were ordering at the cafeteria. And Eric was skeptical that this would actually show any difference, because he'd done some other work showing that philosophers are not really any more ethical than anyone else. But to his surprise, and of course my satisfaction, it did show a statistically significant drop in meat consumption in those who'd taken the meat class. Now, that doesn't mean they all became vegan, but it was enough of a drop to be clear that that was resulting from that change. And it lasted at least several months. We couldn't continue longer because the pandemic then interrupted. So philosophy, reason, ethics does make some difference. But so do many other things, I'm sure. For some people, emotional videos of what is happening to animals will work. For other people, appealing to completely different reasons, like climate change, environmental reasons, or personal health reasons will work and will have an effect. For some people, maybe in-your-face kinds of protests of the sort that Direct Action Everywhere does may have an effect. And maybe for other people, that has a, you know, even puts them off. I don't know. I think we need to try to find out more about these studies. So I think at this stage we're in a learning phase where we want to try to find out what is really most effective. And I should also mention, of course, that providing alternative products that are either plant-based or don't involve a whole animal because they're cellular could be a way of making it easier for people to change too.
I'm sure with most people who are vegan, it baffles all of us quite a bit. You just expect, kind of like when you wrote the first edition and you thought, oh, everyone's going to know now, that would make this massive sweeping difference in terms of the general public. And in a lot of ways, I mean, the world's eating more meat now than ever, and it's going up fast, especially China and pork. We can change a lot of laws here, but unless we start looking at China too, or China starts looking at China, it's a lot of animals.
It is a lot of animals, yes. I'm greatly concerned about what's going on in China, and I'm in contact with people in China, and particular with a collaborator, a researcher in Hong Kong. And there are some signs of other people concerned about this in China, but it's really tiny. You know, if it's small here, then it's just an order of magnitude smaller still in China. And it seems that the attitudes to animals are also less favorable than they are here. So I don't know. I mean, I think China may have to wait for really producing cellular meat. And when they can produce cellular meat that tastes and chews like meat from animals, and when it's economically competitive with meat from animals, perhaps then China will shift. But I don't know that it's going to happen any earlier than that.
One thing you didn't talk about in the first edition, but you talk about now, is fish and fish sentience. Because we didn't really know about fish sentience back then, did we?
Well, we were unsure. I mean, personally, I never had any doubts. You know, one of my earliest kind of what I could now see in hindsight was a sort of pro-animal movement. Was that when I was about 8, I think, I was staying down the beach. You know, this was in Australia where I grew up. Was staying down the beach and some friends of my parents came along and said, would Peter like to go fishing with us? So I went fishing with them, and we threw our lines in the sea, and before long I hauled up a fish, and there it was flapping away on the end of this sharp hook on its mouth, And I didn't like this. And although I didn't say anything to these friends at the time, I guess I was a bit timid about criticizing this or questioning it, I never went fishing again. I didn't want to go fishing again, although I was still eating fish. So, you know, I'm not saying I was morally all that good. But just seemed obvious to me from the way they behave that they're suffering. But you're right, the scientific research wasn't clear. There were some scientists who said, you know, their brains are different in important ways and that may mean that they don't feel pain. But now I think the work of researchers like Victoria Braithwaite and Lynn Snedden makes it very clear that they can feel pain. And so it's partly for that reason that I put in much more material about fish. It's partly also that I feel the public may be more ready to extend concern to fish. When I was writing the first edition, the question was, would the public really care about chickens? Because chickens sort of had a reputation as being stupid animals, which is not true either, of course. And a lot of people said, yeah, I'd care about pigs and cows, but not chickens. So that's another factor. And then the final factor is raising fish in industrial fish production is just grown enormously. And again, particularly in Asia, and particularly in China. And you know, now fish are the majority of farmed vertebrate animals that we produce. And so the numbers are huge. 124 billion fish raised a year is the best estimate that I've seen. So we can't avoid talking about this.
What else was not in the last version that you brought into this one?
So there's more research on our knowledge of sentience generally, and particularly of degrees, you could say, you know, whether there are degrees of confidence anyway that we can have that beings are sentient. So there's some discussion of the possibility of insects being sentient, although I'm still agnostic on that, really. I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question. There's certainly, I think, more confidence that octopus are sentient. And of course, a lot of people have seen that film about my octopus teacher. But there's also a lot of more information about octopus, and some of their behavior clearly is intelligent behavior, solving novel problems or planning ahead for things that are going to happen. So we clearly have invertebrate animals who are sentient. And the United Kingdom, in its recent legislation about sentient animals, which was only necessary actually because the UK left the European Union and was no longer covered by those laws, they added both cephalopods, that's octopus and squids, and decapod crustaceans, which is lobsters and crabs. They added them as sentient animals. So that's interesting that Parliament was sufficiently convinced to add them. And wild animal suffering I brought in because there's been something of a movement in the animal movement, if you like, a subgroup of the animal movement to make us more aware of wild animal suffering, including some of which obviously we know about, we inflict on wild animals. And again, that goes back to fish. Wild caught fish are obviously wild animals and we kill them in all sorts of horrible ways. So that's one. But then there are questions about what we should be doing with respect to suffering in nature. And a lot of suffering occurs in nature. Obviously, some of that is from predators. And people at least raise the question, you know, should we try to do anything about that? What are the values at stake? Are there ecological values in preserving ecosystems which outweigh the suffering that predators inflict on animals? That's one kind of question. And another kind of question is, well, what would happen if you did remove the predators? Because then the prey animals would populate more and eventually maybe they would outgraze their environment and they would starve. And nobody wants that. So effectively, you would then be saying, well, this is now a human-managed park or reservation where we have to make sure that the prey animals don't overpopulate. Maybe we'd find, you know, distribute contraceptives in food they eat. And that's a very different picture of nature, or it's not nature anymore, if you like. So those questions are worth discussing. And I think there are things we can do to reduce wild animal suffering. Obviously, not catching fish is one. Not letting your cat outside at night particularly is another. Installing bird-friendly glass if you're in an area where birds kill themselves flying into your windows. There are not allowing fireworks in places where there are animals around. They disturb wild animals. There are a range of things that you can do. But it's, to me, this is an area for discussion and for some practical implications of the kind I've mentioned. But a lot of these things, I think, are not certainly not a priority and maybe are not things we should be doing at all.
Right. This movement started with you. You've watched it grow, but there's a really long way to go. How do we get there? Like, what has to happen? Yes, technology, for sure.
Well, as well as, you know, changing ourselves and starting with ourselves to make that change in what we eat, we want to be politically active citizens. We should be a really powerful influence. As I said earlier, through parliamentary democracies, in at least some of them, we are a powerful influence already. We can influence governments to change their policies. In the United States, it's harder because of the lobbying interests of agribusiness and of the animal research industry as well, I should say. So we have to become a more effective and more powerful lobby. And that should be possible. You know, there's a huge number of supporters of improvements for animals.
I mean, what I started out with is it feels like the world is shifting so big. And then you look at the numbers. It's heartbreaking. When you look at those numbers and you realize every one of those numbers is a being who's suffering and living a horrific existence.
That's so difficult to really grasp, right? I threw out that figure of the number of fish in industrial farms, which basically means they're all suffering because they're incredibly crowded when they're living. In the case of salmon, say, I'm sure they have instincts to swim distances as they would in nature that they can't do, so they swim around and around in circles. And the methods of slaughter are obviously cruel and painful. So, you know, and then you say 124 billion. What does that mean, right? I mean, it's such a vast figure. It's, what, 15 times the population of the world, and it's hard to imagine the number of people in the world. Yeah. It is. It's such a huge problem.
It's so many individuals, and that's where it's, it's almost impossible.
Each one of them is an individual subject of consciousness, and we are causing them to have a miserable experience throughout their lives, and at the end of it, at least, an extremely painful experience.
Right.
I mean, I think there is hope for change, and I think that's why I brought out Animal Liberation Now. I think this is a moment when we can get more people working for this cause. You know, we have a lot more vegans and a lot more people who are aware of plant-based eating. I think the opportunities for change are there, and we need to seize this moment and do everything we can to take that opportunity.
On Friday, I was at the Vegan Women's Summit, which is fairly new. It's a couple years old, I think. It was in Brooklyn. It was 1,000 women, mostly women. And it was super positive, and everyone was so excited to be there and be vegan. And, you know, but that wasn't happening 10 years ago.
No, that's great. Yeah. I know. That's a terrific movement.
I think the more people read your new book and the more we embrace technology.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe actually the fact that women are now more powerful and more assertive than they used to be is another opportunity for the movement, because I think women are more empathetic with animals. They're perhaps less inhibited in feeling concern for animals than a lot of men are. A lot of men sort of think this is not a tough guy sort of approach. So I think it's terrific that you had 1,000 women at the Vegan Women's Summit there. And I think that's a good source of power for the future.
Yeah, it was exciting. Well, thank you. This was great.
Thank you, Beth. It's been great talking to you.
To learn more about Peter Singer and to order Animal Liberation Now, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I'd like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knutson, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Ayana Peoples, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.